CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, another NDP candidate here in BC has quit his campaign. Concordia University bans Facebook on its campus. And in international news, our own News 101 reporter, Carrie Baptist, brings you exclusive coverage of the International AIDS Conference from Mexico City. We'll have all this plus art, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next hour right here on News 101. Up first is producer Megan Turcato's interview with some UBC engineers and their robot.
This week, I sat down with Thomas Zoy, Brian Ma, and Wee-Ki Toy, three members of a Physics 253 team who won their class's competition to create a crime-fighting robot. The theme of this year's competition was inspired by the death of Robert Jakansky, and the idea was for students to create a non-harmful method of capturing and detaining criminals. I started by asking Thomas to show me his 3D model and explain what went into creating the robot.
When we first start off, 3D modeling is really crude, basically just a bunch of blocks and rectangles. And for wheels, we'd probably just do cylinders, so very, very crude, just to get the general dimensions correct, because there's a size limitations to all the robots. And as we think about the parts more and more, like, for example, the robot arms, you start thinking of how can we make it lightweight and how can we make sure that it supports the right loading on it, it doesn't break when it crashes into something. So then we start getting the real definitions of it out. And then when we get the final shape, we draw into 2D, and then we bring into the water jet cutter, and it basically just prints it for us, so we get a perfect match. So at the end of the day, this model really becomes real life.
So it prints out a stencil for you and you can...
No, it cuts it out of metal. Actually, in this case, we cut it out of carbon fiber reinforced balsa wood. This is actually a 2D printer. It's very close to a 3D printer.
Okay.
We can probably do...
You just need to attach the pieces together.
Pretty much. Attach it.
Next, Thomas showed me some videos of the robot in action. The sounds you hear in the background are enthusiastic cheering from Physics 253 classmates.
Yeah, this is quite an epic final for us.
Yeah, so can you describe a little bit what your robot looks like and what it actually does to apprehend criminals?
Well, I guess from the top view, some people say it looks like the Millennium Falcon because it's got a tapered side.
Yes.
And it's sort of rounded on one end and it has a slot in the middle. In some ways, it does look like the Millennium Falcon, but when you look up to in the front, it has two sort of a Y-shaped capture arm sticking out of it.
So what exactly was your robot required to do in the competition? Like, what was the aim of the competition?
It's designed so that we capture a mobile thief. I guess that's actually the bigger goal. The stationary thieves were initially thought as very easy tasks and just to eliminate the people who couldn't build anything. But it turned out actually that was a lot harder. So I guess it's to capture a remote control car. And this remote control car basically just gives off IR signals. And you're supposed to detect it and basically robot will chase after and capture it somehow. For the first part of the competition, it'll go around on a predestined route and basically capture these stationary thieves, basically dolls on a wooden platter. It'll do that by engulfing it into its slot in the front. So we basically have a gate which opens the slot for capturing, and then we go into it, you drive into the stationary thieves. And once we get into it, we close off the gate and we drive around to its to where we're supposed to place it. And then in the second stage, we have arms that actually come out. Basically, because of size regulations, we couldn't have it out already. So at the start of the second stage, we'll deploy it. And once it comes out, it'll go to the center of the field and then spin, do a scan, track to look for the IR signals. And once it sees it, it'll go towards it. And basically, what we have is two arms, and it forms like a... It just forms a trap area, and we have one-way valves where if the mobile thief ever gets into the trap area, it won't come out. It's pretty much like a one-way door.
Can you describe how your robot detects
the car?
It's basically the car is emitting infrared light. Mm-hmm. You can't see it, but you could see it actually on your cell phone cameras or any camcorder. It'll be like a regular LED light, except just human eyes can't see it. And the robot will have infrared detectors that, as the intensity of light gets stronger and stronger, it'll get a higher voltage reading.
Mm-hmm. What do you think gave your robot the upper hand over your classmates' robots?
It's just the simplicity. It's very well executed. We didn't have any electronic issues. Just reliability and simplicity gave us the edge, I think. And our mechanical design is pretty good. It kind of takes the stress off of our electronic components because we don't rely on anything too electronic. For example, just our both capture mechanisms for the stationary and the mobile thieves, it doesn't really rely on much electronics. It basically is just a hole. It's just a trap area. And once the stationary thief or the mobile thief gets in the trap area, we close it off. And actually, in the mobile thief's case, we don't actually even close it off as electronics. It just closes off by itself. So it takes a lot of stress off. Whereas other people, they have arms that try to grab it, which mm-hmm. does need extra electronics to coordinate the arms and everything, and it becomes a mess once you have designs like that.
Did your robot have a name?
yes, it's called Too Fast, Too Fourier.
Is there a story behind that name?
I'm not sure. You should ask my friend here.
Actually, we were just learning about a mathematical theory called Fourier transformation in our class. Mm-hmm. And we were learning a technique called fast Fourier transformation. And I was pretty bored, so I just talked to another team member of mine about Too Fast, Too Fourier. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think much about it, but he thought that it was a good name for the team.
Well, it does transform partway through, so.
So what did you find to be the hardest part of designing and building the robot?
Just finalizing the design, because there's so many options we can take with this robot. I mean, the instructors didn't have any idea how it would look like, so mm-hmm. it could be, you know, anywhere. And if you see other robots, they really do look different. I think for one of the robots, the capture mechanism for the first part was actually like an arm. Looks like a humanoid arm. And for the second part, some people just use the little wedge. so it's anything you want. Anything you can think of, you can make. So finalizing the design is really tough. I mean, we spend like tons of nights just thinking over designs that we can make and then scrapping it because we thought, no, it wasn't good enough. And I think in the end, it did pay off thinking about it that much.
So do you see any practical applications for your robot in law enforcement?
To be honest, not this stage. It's still too simple. I mean, it's a second year project.
Yeah.
All the technology we're using here is fairly basic, I would say. And law enforcement, no. I don't think the thieves will be wearing infrared light.
Fair enough. So has this class made you guys want to work with robots and electronics in the future?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's definitely a great field to work in. Quite a bit to think about. I mean, the funnest part, I would think, is the design of the robot, because there's just so many different ways you can, so many different approaches you can go to, you know, to get the end goal. And it's just fun thinking about which is the best, and then ultimately seeing your 3D design on your, you know, on your computer-aided design program, that solid model become like a reality, which is really neat.
So we have like. Yeah,
and thank you so much to Megan for that piece. Up next, it's Radio Free UBC, and here initially is Jeremy Wood.
Hey, 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 UBC. Welcome back to Radio Free. Your progressive angle on the news story is at school, affecting school, and hopefully affecting you on UBC and in the city. So turn on, tune in, drop out, and stay with us for a while. We're going to be starting with our main story, with Andrea Morgan, who's going to be talking about the UBC Farm and the upcoming Food is Fundamental conference put on by the Student Environmental Center. So
we've been hearing a lot about this Food is Fundamental conference. Just wondering, what are some of the events that are going to be going on?
Well, the conference is from Tuesday, September 23rd, to Saturday, September 26th. The rough breakdown is just during the week, there will be several lectures and presentations, panels going on throughout the week. Most of them are from 12 to 2 p.m. We have other events going on in the evenings and just during the afternoon, such as a composting tour, green buildings tour. Cinema Politica this week on Tuesday night will be showing The Power of Community about how Cuba has survived peak oil. And then we move on to Farm Aid on Friday, September 26th, which is going to be an awesome party. I highly encourage everyone to go. There will be beer, food, art, music, children's areas. It's just a big open-air festival on the farm. And then Saturday is the biggest day of the conference. We have a whole bunch of workshops planned in the morning on the farm at the site. And then in the afternoon, we have several keynote speakers and awesome presentations on things such as the Haiti food crisis. We have jam and bread and beer making workshops. We've got a keynote speaker from the States coming in to talk about agriculture and the importance of it in today's world. And then a closing remark about the UBC farm.
Wow, sounds really cool. How much does it cost?
It's free for anyone who decides to come. And, you can register at our website, www.foodisfundamental.com. Everything is free. We're going to have free food. Community Eats is doing our dinner for us on Saturday. And, the whole thing is free. So I highly encourage everyone to come.
Sweet. Who's sponsoring Food is Fundamental?
We have several sponsors as of right now, the Department of Global Resource Systems, the Graduate Student Society, Friends of the UBC Farm, Student Environment Center, and the UBC Farm itself.
Okay, what's the goal of this conference?
The goal of this conference is to raise awareness about food and what we eat, how it affects this world, its people, its environment, its economy. In a global context, and then we're ultimately bringing it down to the issue of the UBC farm and the threats of development that it is currently facing. This conference is part of a larger campaign to save the farm and preserve it as it is forever.
With regards to that, what's the current state of the planning process of the farm with regards to development?
October is going to be a big month for that. There are going to be several design workshops that anyone is welcome to participate in the middle of October. If you want to sign up for one of those, go to the campus and community planning website and type in design workshops, UBC Farm. You'll find something. The decision is going to be made in October, coming up with several plans and ideas about what to put on there, and students' voices really need to be heard, so get your voice out there.
That's definitely going to check that out.
Cool.
All right, I wanted to thank, we want to thank Ariel Friedman again for interviewing Andrea there. Next up, we have Greg Williams, Ariel again, and Shrazi Indisari, who are going to be giving a few upcoming announcements of progressive, radical things going on in the city and on campus.
So, hello, UBC. Speaking of the farm, apparently Joyce Marie, the incumbent liberal in the city council, is very big...
Federal.
I'm new to the radio, sorry. The incumbent liberal is very big on the farm, and that's just one of several candidates that are going to be participating in an all-candidates debate on Thursday, the 25th, from 1 to 3 in the Conversation Pit of the Sub. The others are Michael Byers, who's actually a UBC prof. He's been big on rendition, torture in general. And then Deborah Meredith is the conservative candidate, and she's actually here on campus today speaking about the crisis in Darfur. Right outside the sub on the Knoll, so much props to her on that. And Adrian Carr from the Green Party is also going to be there. And in other radical news, there is a protest tomorrow at the U.S. consulate in Vancouver. That's 1095 West Pender. It's at 4 p.m. It's against American interventionalism in Venezuela. And some more information on that, you can go to handsoffvenezuela.org.
Vision Vancouver, it's having its counselor nominations tomorrow from 10 to 7 at Charles Tupper High School, 419th East 24th. You should check it out. Among the nominees is David Eby, who has worked with Pivot in defense of residences of downtown Eastside and on poverty issues. On the subject of Pivot, they're all having a fundraiser tomorrow night, too, at 7:30, St. James Community Square. That's 3124 West 10th, and it's called Taking a Stand on Housing. So,
hey, everyone. Here's some radical activism. The Olympics Resistance Network activists and concerned residents will be disrupting the Canadian Pacific Spirit Train launch in Port Moody on Sunday, September 21st at 2 p.m. The Spirit Train is in town on a cross-country journey to spread the Olympic spirit. Now, DRN stands with the statement that the Spirit Train embodies the synergies between the corporate sector and the Olympics carried out in the name of colonialist Canadian nationalism. The event in Port Moody will be one of the first and a series of actions against the Spirit Train planned across the country. If you want more information, go to no2010.org or .com.
All right. Thank you, UBC. That's all we got for you today. Hope you heard something you found interesting, maybe something you want to attend or think about. Anyways, UBC, you're rad. Stay rad. We'll see you next week.
And thanks, as always, to Radio Free UBC for their content. Stay tuned next week at about the same time for more from them. We're going to go to a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on some local and provincial news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR.
Hey, are you ready to head back to school in September?
For sure, but I'm worried that I won't be able to cover all my costs this year.
Have you ever done work study? I did it in the past, and it was a great experience and good money. You just need to be a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident.
And studying at UBC?
You got it. If you want to earn decent coin, pad your resume, and work on campus, work study is where the smart money's at. Just go online to Career Services and check out the listings.
That's solid advice. I'll definitely check out work study this year.
For more information on getting hired for a work-study job, visit www.students.ubc.ca/work-study.
I'm Walter Cronkite. I'd like you to hear something.
Any way you want it, that's the way you need it. Any way you want it.
They're radio hams, amateurs, giving of their own time and spending their own money.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Your volunteer-run station.
They're just two average guys who saw the need and volunteered.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Rita Farkas coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. The federal New Democratic Party has lost yet another BC candidate today, the second to quit this week. This afternoon, Vancouver Quadra candidate Kirk Tousaw, a civil liberties lawyer and former campaign manager for the BC Marijuana Party, resigned. Tousaw has been a longtime advocate for the legalization of marijuana and once appeared on Pot TV, a website run by party leader Mark Emery. He is also chair of the BC Civil Liberties Association's Drug Policy Committee. Tousaw released a statement today saying his difficult decision was made partly because of the events in the last few days. He says he is concerned about the likelihood that his past involvement with drug policy reform work could distract the campaign away from more pressing issues that are important to Canadians. He said he still believes the NDP has the right ideas and policies on the environment, healthcare, the economy, and ending Canadian involvement in the war in Afghanistan. As our listeners may recall, another NDP candidate, Dana Larson, also quit his campaign in West Vancouver's Sunshine Coast after video footage of his public use of marijuana and LSD surfaced and was reported by the media. Now, with more local and provincial news, here in studio are News 101 reporters Sarah Ripplinger and Carrie Baptist.
Nine people have been arrested after the police dismantled a drug trafficking operation allegedly masterminded by a 19-year-old from Terrace, BC. One of the officers, Shield, said in a news release that the man was arrested when he walked out of a classroom after writing an exam at Northwest Community College. Investigators conducted surveillance activity and telephone interceptions and had seized a cache of cocaine, marijuana, and ecstasy. The drug ring originated in Terrace and expanded outward. Police are recommending charges against 5 of the 9 people arrested Thursday, including the 19-year-old man.
BC Ferries is maintaining its fuel surcharge despite a recent drop in oil prices. The corporation informed CBC News that the British Columbia Ferries passengers will most likely have to pay a fuel surcharge for several months, even though the oil prices are dropping. Earlier this week, both Air Canada and WestJet announced they would be dropping fuel surcharges and lowering extra baggage fees after the price of oil fell. At the pumps, the price of gasoline in BC continues to drop, with many stations across the province selling below $1.30 a litre, down from more than $1.50 earlier this week. But BC Ferries President David Hahn says falling oil prices don't translate into an immediate surplus of cash for the company, and there are no plans for immediate price cuts. Since August, BC Ferries travelers have been paying fuel surcharges between 9 and 18% on the price of tickets to help the corporation cover the rising price of oil.
Sierra Club BC is reeling after $100,000 of grant money for its Circles program was rescinded by the federal government. A former senior policy advisor on energy for the Sierra Club of Canada decried the funding cut, calling it a vengeful act designed to punish the Sierra Club. John Bennett, the current director of communications for the Green Party, accused Environment Minister John Baird of playing partisan politics, unjustly targeting the organization for having ties to the Liberal Party. A formal contract for the $100,000 grant money was originally signed between the Sierra Club BC and the Federal EcoAction Community Funding Program in May 2008. Earlier this month, the government revoked the funding, leaving the Circles program in jeopardy of being shut down. According to the Sierra Club website, the Carbon Emission Reduction Clubs, or CIRCLES, program is designed to help small groups launch workshops that teach people how to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Training and workshop materials were available through Sierra Club BC to support the groups. The nonprofit organization is now looking for donations from the public to keep the program running. You can visit the Sierra Club BC website for more details at www.sierraclub.bc.ca.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break, but stay tuned to CITR for more news following these public service announcements.
A beautiful day without a cloud.
The 27th Annual Vancouver International Film Festival will be held September 25th to October 10th, 2008. VIFF is among the largest film festivals in North America and is one of the largest cultural events in Canada. The broad spectrum of fiction and non-fiction films from around the world is divided into the following sections. The Ark, Elements and Animals. Dragons and Tigers, The Cinemas of East Asia. Non-fiction features. Canadian Images, Cinema of Our Time, and Spotlights on France.
Films are screened on the following 10 screens: Empire Granville 7 Cinemas, Van City Theatre at the Vancouver International Film Centre, Pacific Cinematheque, Ridge Theatre. To purchase tickets, visit the Vancouver International Film Festival Centre on Seymour. For information, check out www.viff.org or call 604-683-FILM. That's 604-683-3456.
Yes, it comes in a downward direction. It disintegrates, dissolves, melts everything.
Shindig!
Well, thank you very much. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. Howdy, hi, Shindiggers. Come on in and join the fun.
Starting September 16th at the Railway Club, CITR presents Shindig. Shindig continues its tradition of offering the freshest underground music in this annual competition that spans 13 weeks and includes over 1,000 participants. 27 bands and musicians of all styles duke it out to grab one of three prize-winning top slots. With three great bands each night and free audience prizes, what more can you ask for? This week's challengers are
Against Civilization, Analog Bell Service, and Zombie Pistolero and His Guns.
Come on down every Tuesday at 9 o'clock to the Railway Club, 579 Dunsmuir Street, for Shindig, where
you get to see the stars of tomorrow today. You don't have to wait an extra day.
Why, sometimes I'd like
the switchblade and the Cadillac, throw it all in the fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh yeah.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:29. This week, Concordia University has banned access to Facebook on campus computers, the CBC reports. University staff asserts that the university's desktop network is vulnerable to hackers who may be using popular social networking site to access personal information. With more on this story, which has been brought to us by our own human rights reporter, Brad Pepnick, here once again is Carrie Baptist.
Concordia is concerned that the information that could then be used to launch attacks on its systems. This development has left the question about the role of Facebook as a tool for communication and the risks it involves. Is denying students access to Facebook crucial to maintaining technological safety, or is Facebook and the internet so paramount to freedom that Concordia should reevaluate their intentions? This role of technology and the access to the internet plays a crucial role in political spheres and how information is distributed. As we have come to learn, foreign and domestic journalists suffered major censorship in Beijing before and during the Olympics. Access to human rights sites such as Amnesty International and sites concerning Tibet, Tiananmen Square, or the religious sect Falun Gong were denied to reporters covering the Olympics. Amnesty International also reports major human rights violation amongst journalists in China, citing the imprisonment of those who reported on human rights abuses. The topic of human rights and access to technology was also recently addressed in an episode of Radio Netherlands, The State We're In. Questions of how the access to the internet is a key factor in ensuring the democratic process were highlighted in stories of how Facebook use encourages activists in Egypt and Turkey, as well as a story on the political sphere of blogging in the Middle East. Cell phones used by reporters and ordinary citizens give voice to those oppressed by war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo via text messaging, and this suggests a new age of political dialogue. Documenting the Iraq war by civilians on their cell phones gives a proportional image of true events beyond the censoring hands of the media.
Images from NASA's AQUA satellite show that Arctic sea ice may be reaching its lowest levels ever recorded this summer. The near loss of Arctic ice in the waters around the northern ice pack has members of the World Wide Fund for Nature calling for immediate government action on climate change. The WWF say that record low ice levels over the past 2 years could signal a catastrophic trend that threatens polar wildlife and heightened levels of global warming. Senior climate advisor of the WWF's Arctic program in Oslo, Norway, Martin Summercorn, commented that the Northwest Passage over the top of North America and the Northeast Passage over the top of Russia were both ice-free for the first time this year. Trent University scientist Derek Mueller reported another indication of rapid climate changes last month when an ice shelf almost the size of Manhattan broke away from Canada's northern Arctic. One principal concern is that the increase in ice melt will lead to more exposed water, which absorbs the sun's heat, as opposed to ice, which reflects the sun's rays. This could lead to a positive feedback loop, where ice melt can lead to more warming and more ice melt. The WWF is calling for governments to accelerate talks about global warming and to come up with a new plan to address climate change and slow Arctic ice melt.
And in other international news, China's latest tainted product scandal, which was confined to tainted milk powder, has recently widened to liquid milk after laboratory tests revealed the presence of contamination in the products. The liquid milk samples were produced by China's top three leading dairy companies, two of which, incidentally, export dairy products to Canada. The contamination in most of the liquid milk was due to a toxic chemical substance known as melanin, which can be responsible for kidney stones as well as kidney failure.
Also from China, the Beijing Olympics may have shone a light on China's unprecedented industrialization and high levels of air pollution, but the world's most populous nation now looks to be turning its economic development hat in for a sustainable development one. According to a report in the United Kingdom online publication The Telegraph, China is set to become the world's largest investor in green energy. The country is now poised to build the world's first eco-city and has spent the equivalent of about $11.5 billion Canadian on renewable energy projects last year. And this year, China's ruling Communist Party has pledged to double its efforts. One of the most promising endorsements of China's new green direction came from Greenpeace, who claims the country may soon produce half its energy from renewable sources. The Chinese government plans to reverse the effects of years of degrading soil and waterways in the interest of breakneck economic growth by enacting stringent environmental laws, punishing governors who don't clean up pollution, and by relying on gains in the renewable technology market. China is presently a world leader in the manufacture of solar panels, solar hot water heating systems, and wind turbines.
And in other international news, we bring you exclusive coverage of the recent International AIDS Conference, which took place in Mexico City. Here is News 101's very own reporter, Carrie Baptist.
In early August, I attended the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City. For CITR, I'm covering just a few of the issues discussed at the conference. The first one I'd like to talk about is the gap between research and policymaking. In the context of the AIDS epidemic, there is a growing body of research that provides evidence of programs and interventions that are the most effective in preventing HIV transmission. Nonetheless, this data is often overlooked when public policy is drafted. Due to the controversial nature of behaviors associated with sexual and drug-related transmission of AIDS, certain interest groups associated to religious or business leaders often use their power to influence policy according to their ideology or moral beliefs, rather than the available research data. In the United States, this can take the form of opposition to comprehensive sex education in public schools, with many groups favoring abstinence education instead, which does not include information on correct condom usage, which is key to preventing the transmission of HIV/AIDS. This comes in light of a recent report by the Center of Disease Control in the United States, which revised up their estimate for the prevalence of HIV/AIDS in America. Frances Kissling, the president of Catholics for Free Choice, brings up some of the difficulties in the fight to base sex education on research rather than ideology or values.
We gotta get in his face as a D-line. We gotta get pressure on him, otherwise he'll sit there. He'll pick us apart. Great quarterback, great arm, smart. You know, give him any time and he'll pick us apart, and that's what he's done the last couple of years.
When I think about evidence and how it's treated, I'm at times pessimistic and at times optimistic. I have heard high-level officials in Washington state something like, when it comes to sexual behavior among young people, it is not research that counts, it is values that count. And they would then dismiss all the research. On the other hand, I have also myself presented the evidence that I'm going to show you in one state, and within 10 hours, the governor of that state reversed that state's policies regarding abstinence education. So I see positive and negative examples. If we're going to talk about research-based policy, we then need to know, what does the research say? And that's what I'm going to show you today. In the U.S., there are, if I can actually read the screen, just barely, there are 8 abstinence programs which evaluated the impact upon studies which measure the impact on abstinence-only programs. Of those 8, only one of them found that that program actually delayed the initiation of sex. What I'm looking at is this column right here. 7 of them had no impact at all. There were 6 programs that looked upon the measure the impact upon frequency of sex. 2 of them may have reduced frequency of sex. 4 had no impact. 5 studies looked at the impact on numbers of partners. 1 may have reduced the number of partners. 4 had no impact. All of those studies did in fact meet criteria for inclusion. However, some of those studies were much more rigorous. They were large randomized trials. All of those studies consistently found that the abstinence-only programs had no impact on any sexual behavior at all. That's in great contrast to the right-hand column, where we see that there are 32 studies of comprehensive programs. And by comprehensive, what I mean are programs that emphasize that not having sex is the safest and best approach for young people, but that if they do have sex, they should always use condoms and contraception to protect themselves. There we see almost half of the studies actually delayed the initiation of sex. We look at the impact upon other behaviors. We see the abstinence programs had no positive effects, whereas the comprehensive programs did.
Sorry about the confusion. That was Dr. Douglas Kirby, a renowned researcher in the sex education field, who presented some of the raw data on the effectiveness of abstinence education in high schools in the U.S. versus a more comprehensive sex education curriculum. The Franceless Kissing file was corrupted, but I'll be doing a small series of these segments from the conference every Friday, and I'll be highlighting a different social issue raised at the conference. And next week, I'll be talking about increased criminalization of AIDS.
And thank you so much to Carrie Baptist for that piece. Stay tuned for the next clip coming up next Friday. In international news, we now bring you a piece from Free Speech Radio News on the protest against a controversial Arizona sheriff.
A coalition of groups protested at Wells Fargo headquarters in San Francisco Thursday, demanding the bank stop leasing office space to a controversial sheriff in Arizona. Activists have likened the struggle for immigrant rights in Arizona to the Black civil rights movement in Mississippi. FSRN's Africa Jones reports.
Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County in Arizona likes to call himself America's toughest sheriff, but immigration and human rights activists accuse him of using his department to racially profile Latinos and deport undocumented immigrants. Renee Salcedo is an organizer with the San Francisco Day Labor Program.
We want Wells Fargo to stop leasing space to this racist Sheriff Arpaio and stop benefiting and profiting from his racist law enforcement tactics.
Even the mayor of Phoenix, which is located in Maricopa County, has spoken out against the sheriff's racial profiling. Gerald Lenar is a coordinator with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, a Berkeley-based organization challenging U.S. immigration policy.
Sheriff Arpaio has the nerve to call immigrants who come here undocumented illegal. We say that he is the one who's breaking the law.
That's right.
I'm old enough to remember a time during the civil rights movement where we had a sheriff in Birmingham, Alabama, who sicked dogs on young kids, who jailed hundreds of civil rights activists. His name was Bull Connor. Today we have Sheriff Arpaio, who is the Bull Connor of our age.
Thank you very much.
Several activists wanted to speak with Wells Fargo and give them a list of demands, but Wells Fargo Communications Director Chris Heyman would only meet with Salcedo.
We're so proud to support the Latino community. Thank you for visiting with us.
Well, you're not supporting the Latino community
at all. We absolutely are really proud of our track record.
You are attacking our community, particularly in Phoenix, Arizona, through your leasing of space to Sheriff Arpaio. Is Wells Fargo willing to commit
We invited you in.
To retract its lease from Sheriff Arpaio's office in Phoenix, Arizona. That's really our question.
We are so proud of our support of the Latino community and our track record here. And as far as the specific tenants that we may have, we make it a practice not to comment for sake of their privacy.
Well, if you'd be willing to meet with this delegation, representative of our various constituencies.
Unfortunately, our space, we have to run our business, and this space will not
accommodate. Sir, I can't believe that Wells Fargo doesn't have enough space to accommodate a group of
five people.
Thank you.
We'd be happy to, again, Renee, we can meet with you at another place. No.
Renee Salcedo says that activists will continue to protest.
We will not tolerate Wells Fargo having its corporate headquarters here in San Francisco and supporting this racist sheriff and deporting our folks. We're just not going to tolerate it. So in the same way we pressured companies like Wells Fargo to divest from South Africa during the anti-apartheid movement, we're going to do the same thing now through the immigrant rights movement. We're going to force these companies to be held accountable and not profit from anti-immigrant and racist behavior.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
Federal authorities conducted raids in the Bay Area, Chicago, Indiana, and Colorado this week, arresting more than 200 people. In the Bay Area, 21 people were taken to detention centers after being charged with administrative immigration violations after federal agents raided several restaurants and houses. Those arrested include people from China, Mexico, Guatemala, Indonesia, Singapore, and Honduras. According to ICE, one person has been released on humanitarian grounds, pending a future hearing before an immigration judge. In Chicago, Indiana, and Colorado, many of those detained include what ICE calls, quote, fugitive immigrants, or those who fail to appear at an immigration hearing.
And thanks, as always, to Free Speech Radio News for their piece. Up next, we're going to give you a little taste of the Thunderbird Ion Sports. Here's Tyler Noble.
All right, thanks very much, Rita. Yes, it's game day for the UBC Thunderbirds football team, which is looking for its third straight victory as they play host to the Regina Rams later tonight. The T-Birds are a confident bunch after a massive 28-0 shutout of the defending national champion Manitoba Bisons last week to move into a four-way tie for first place in the Canada West. Including in that victory were record-setting performances for two members of the Blue and Gold. 50-year kicker Sean McIsaac made good on 7 field goal attempts, tying a Canada West record set back in 1996, and earning himself Canada West Special Team Player of the Week honors. Scott McQuaig, meanwhile, became the all-time Canada West leader in sacks with his 4th and 5th of the season, bringing his career total to 23. But things likely won't be as smooth tonight as the Birds face an underachieving Regina Rams team looking for its first win of the season. Regina is also fresh off a bye week, and the extra time means they will be able to field all of their regular starters tonight. Receiver Jordan Sisco will get his first playing time tonight after missing the first two games due to a case of mono. He led the Rams in receiving last season, and his return couldn't be more appropriate as he picked up 175 all-purpose yards and 2 touchdowns when these teams met in Regina at this time last year. The UBC defense will have to keep him in check, as is the case for quarterback Teal Orban, who is easily the best pivot in the Canada West Conference. Rush and Scott McQuaig, who I mentioned just a moment ago, says the UBC front seven must get pressure on Orban if they hope to be successful here at Thunderbird Stadium tonight.
Sean, otherwise he'll sit there and he'll pick us apart. Great quarterback, great arm, smart. You know, give him any time and he'll pick us apart, and that's what he's done the last couple of years.
The Rams down the T-Birds 55-28 in their lone meeting last season, a game in which UBC led 21-3 midway through the second quarter. Kickoff is set for 7 p.m. here at Thunderbird Stadium, and you can catch the game live on CITR 101.9 FM. Thunderbird hockey fans can get their first look at a completely made-over men's team this weekend as they host the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology for a pair of exhibition games tonight and tomorrow. Head coach Milan Dragicevic says despite losing 13 players from last year's roster, this year's recruiting class looks very promising. The games this weekend will be the only tune-up opportunities for the Birds before heading to Calgary to open the regular season next weekend. Games we'll have here on CITR. The exhibition tilt tonight goes at 7:30 p.m. at Father Bauer Arena over at the Winter Sports Center, with the rematch tomorrow night also at 7:30. The first game of the UBC men's volleyball season wasn't a particularly clean affair, but the Birds ended their exhibition road tilt versus the Thompson Rivers Wolfpack on a good note, coming from behind in a 5-set victory last night. UBC erased a 2-set deficit to win the match by set scores of 19-25, 22-25, 25-20, 25-22, and 15-10. Second-year outside hitter Robert Bennett led the way for the Birds with 15 kills. The T-Birds will face the Pack tonight in another exhibition game, but that one will take place in Kelowna at the UBC Okanagan campus, so the Birds will sort of have home court advantage. Last season, the Wolfpack surprised many across the CIS, earning a bronze medal at the national championship. UBC finished 5th. It was a solid start to the season for the women's field hockey squad last weekend with a pair of road wins over the Alberta Pandas. The Thunderbirds now face their other Alberta rivals, the Calgary Dinos, for a pair tomorrow and Sunday. The Thunderbirds had little problem dispatching the Dinos in their 4 meetings last year. Calgary finished last in the Canada West with a 1-9-2 record, but that one victory was the Dinos' first since 2003, and their play was so improved that coach Jen Swager won her first Canada West Coach of the Year award. The Dinos opened their regular season last week against Victoria, dropping the games by scores of 2-1 and 4-1. UBC head coach Hash Kanji says those results against the Vikes proved that Calgary shouldn't be taken lightly this season.
They only lost 2-1 in the first game, and then I think in the second game they were tied at the half, 1-1, only to go down 4-1 in the second half. So, you know, that's they've played 3 quarters of those 2 games. Very, very even. So I'm a bit concerned. I want to know what this team's about, and we look forward to seeing them on Saturday.
Calgary and UBC square off tomorrow afternoon at 2:00 and Sunday afternoon at 1:00, and of course both games are at Wright Field. The defending national champion UBC men's soccer team is back at home this weekend, taking on the Calgary Dinos and Lethbridge Pronghorns tomorrow and Sunday, respectively. The Thunderbirds have not allowed a goal against in their last 3 matches and sit tied for 2nd in the Canada West with 8 points, just 1 back of the conference-leading Victoria Vikes. Both the Dinos and Horns currently sit in the Canada West basement, but UBC head coach Mike Mosier says this weekend could be somewhat of a struggle as the 2 Southern Alberta squads play a very direct style.
They only lost 2-1 in the first game, and then
the ball's up in the air a lot. You're fighting for balls that come off people's heads, And then, you know, there's a lot of pressure to try and get the ball down on the ground and start knocking it around, which is what we want to do. With their pressure, sometimes, you know, you do get caught into playing sort of more their style or what they want to do. So that's the challenge for us, is to, you know, find our moments to get the ball down and play.
UBC midfielder Nick Poole has had a great season so far. He's tied for the CIS lead in goals with six so far, including last Saturday's game winner against the University of the Fraser Valley. The start time for tomorrow's match with the Dinos is 2:15 p.m. over at Thunderbird Park, with Sunday's tilt against Lethbridge also at 2:15 p.m. Calgary and Lethbridge could be more of a challenge for UBC's women's soccer team, as they too return to their home pitch this weekend. The Lady Birds have had trouble finding the back of the net so far this season, notching just 7 goals through 4 matches, but some stellar defense has kept their record to an impressive 2-0-2. The Pronghorns, meanwhile, could put up a good fight, as they sit just 1 point back of the second-place Thunderbirds in the Canada West Conference. Tomorrow's match with the Calgary Dinos provides UBC with a golden opportunity to rise in the standings. As is the case on the men's side, the Calgary women sit last in the conference, still looking for their first win of the season, having let in 9 goals in just 4 matches. UBC, though, has been defensively solid, allowing just 2 goals in 4 matches, largely due to the play of veteran keeper Jackie Dunnett. High noon is the start time for women's soccer, both tomorrow against Calgary and again on Sunday versus Lethbridge. The UBC men's rugby team is looking to record their first win of the year this weekend in Surrey. The Thunderbirds will take on the Bayside Sharks tomorrow in BC Rugby Union action. Wilson
UBC lost the 2-point game last weekend to start their season. Coach Spence McTavish says his team is young and lacks depth at some positions. They've lost captain Henry McQueen and utility forward Luke Dinley to graduation. But McTavish says he has a good batch of rookies and his squad is more athletic than last year's team. McTavish hopes his players can use that to their advantage against Bayside this weekend.
Bayside's usually a bigger team, and they're usually fairly strong in the forwards. So our game is going to try and move the ball around quite a bit and move the ball from sideline to sideline, so to make their big forwards run. And hopefully we can poop them out.
Game time is 2:30 p.m. Saturday at South Surrey Athletic Park. Wilson Wong, CITR Sports Vancouver.
And finally, a reminder that coming up later tonight here on CITR 101.9 FM, UBC Thunderbirds football versus the University of Regina Rams. Our pregame show gets underway at 6:30 p.m. And then I'll be back here alongside Asa Raymond, Ryan Sullivan, and Wilson Wong at Thunderbird Stadium with the play-by-play call starting at 7 o'clock sharp. You can probably hear the music starting to fire up here as they get the pregame festivities underway. We hope you can make plans to join us later on tonight on CITR-FM. That's your Thunderbird Eye on Sports for this Friday. Rita, back to you.
Thanks so much for that, Tyler, and we will stay tuned for more CITR Thunderbird news at 6:30. We're going to cut now to a quick PSA break, and when we come back, we will bring you weather and your local art scene.
Community Services Society of BC is calling out for volunteers for the KidStart Mentoring Program. The KidStart Mentoring Program matches kids 6 years old and older with an adult mentor. This program is similar to the Big Brothers, except geared towards kids at risk, vulnerable to addiction, crime, abuse, and family crisis. At this moment, there are 243 children and youth waiting for a KidStart volunteer. To volunteer or for more information regarding the KidStart Mentoring Program or PLEA Community Services, please visit our websites, www.plea.ca and www.kidstart.ca.
Are you a band or musician located in Vancouver or the Lower Mainland? We're now accepting entries for Shindig 2008. All styles are welcome, whether you're a solo country artist or a 10-piece punk band.
You'll need to send us a minimum 3-song demo of original material, plus your contact information. Put everything in an envelope. Mail it or drop it off before August 8th to Shindig 2008, CITR Radio, number 233/6138, Sub Boulevard, Vancouver, BC, V6T1Z1, Canada.
We also love web-based submissions, such as ones via MySpace or electronic press kits. Please email shindig.08@gmail.com.
You know, as much as I hate to brag about Shindig, I must say tonight we got a Shindig for you that is so far in, it's out of sight.
Hey, we're J+J+J, and I bet you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The sitar.
We call it that. Do you?
You should. Unless you don't like sitars.
On Wednesday, September 24th, CITR and Mint Records presents Novalero with Friends. The details and the good news. Winnipeg locals Novalero have just released their third record, A Little Tradition, and now they are hitting the road to celebrate. The band shall be visiting the Bergen on September 24th for their Vancouver CD release show.
That's Novalero with the details and the good news at the Bergen, 50 Cordova Street on Wednesday, September 24th. Brought to you by Mint Records and CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
And now we're going to check in with meteorologist Henry Fung for a look at your weekend weather.
If you haven't gotten used to the dreary, cloudy days, well, I got more for you this weekend. The blocking pattern keeps the south coast cloudy with sunny breaks but dry tomorrow. But the pattern will break by Sunday morning as a weakened cold front approaches, and we will see some light showers. Areas near Georgia Strait and the North Shore Mountains are more likely to see lingering showers on Monday. So for tonight, low of 12. Cloudy and steady 16 degrees tomorrow. Same for Sunday, with a 60% chance of showers. And for Monday, cloudy with 40% chance of showers and high of 14. That's the weather for this weekend.
Thank you so much for that, Henry. That's a look at your weekend weather. That's it for this week's program, Friday, September 19th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can always email news@citr.ca. Megan Turcato produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Rita Farkas, thanking you for listening. Coming up next is Wings, followed by CITR Sports Fridays. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hey, what's wrong?
I've been looking for a job since I came to Canada, and I haven't found anything.
Have you tried WorkLearn?
What's WorkLearn?
Part-time jobs on campus for international undergraduate students just like us help me find a great job that's actually related to my studies.
Wow! I'll have to check that out.
You should. It's good pay, good experience, and good for your career. Just look for WorkLearn postings at www.careersonline.ubc.ca. You can even ask your profs and campus staff if they can create a job for you.
To participate in WorkLearn, you must be an international student seeking an undergraduate degree in a participating faculty and registered full-time with a study permit valid for at least 6 months. For more information, visit www.careers.ubc.ca.
women who were injured by landmines. And after the injury, they have been abandoned. And yet, they are abandoned with the children.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings.